66. Et ça fait beaucoup de jeux de regard.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's discussions about possibly waiving dockage fees for local vessels.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
With an eye on supporting education, waterfront activity, and tourism, Council unanimously voted at their last meeting on Tuesday to explore options to waive or discount dockage fees at city-operated marinas and ports, specifically for vessels that contribute to community and tourism events or that offer free educational or public programming. The motion brought forward by Councillor Don Amos specifically references the tall ship St. Lawrence II, based out of Portsmouth Olympic Harbor. The ship, which calls Kingston's waterfront home, offers hands-on experiential education programs. Chris Chafe, Executive Director of Tallship Expeditions Canada Brigantine, came before Council to speak on behalf of the program and its impact.
Over the years, our community has grown increasingly distant from the water as a result of ever-compounding barriers to access. Even low-barrier avenues have become prohibitively expensive and are often viewed as not for them by some economically disadvantaged and racialized Kingstonians. Half the youth we serve have never been on the water. This is a trend we want to see reversed by breaking down those barriers and enabling access for underserved members of our community. The lake isn't just a pretty backdrop. It isn't just a racetrack for wealthy sailors, nor is it a fishing pond for the well-to-do. The lake is the biggest public space we have and should be available to everyone. We've made an offer to staff to operate a barrier-free sailing and water access program to the community, as well as to open a boater and education space available to boaters and visitors at POH and the community more broadly in the past OLS location. The city recently made a sizable investment in that space to support the sleeping cabin project, which has now been sitting vacant for 2 years. We are offering the opportunity to breathe new life into a space by opening it to the public. It's been difficult for us to understand the city's position on mooring fees. All the ports we visit, Thunder Bay, St. John's, New York City, Halifax, Yananaque, and over a month in Lunenburg, all of these spaces were provided free of charge, and they were very happy to have us there, right, to open up the boat, to have youth engage with the ship. The only exception seems to be Kingston.
City staff are already in the process of reviewing Portsmouth Olympic Harbor as part of a broader visioning process. That work is focused on aligning site uses with Kingston's waterfront, supporting sailing, water sports, community access, and other opportunities. In bringing the motion forward, Councillor Amos pointed to the role tall ships and other specialty vessels play in strengthening Kingston's tourism profile, supporting waterfront activity, and fostering community pride. He also noted that other Canadian ports and marinas, such as Halifax and St. John's, already have programs in place that waive or reduce docking fees for educational and charitable vessels in recognition of their public value.
If you think of the 1800s, our waterfront was plastered with these type of ships, and now we don't have that. We don't have this type of ship that's coming into our ports very often, and this is a tourism opportunity for us. This is an opportunity for people to come out onto the dock, jump on the boat, see what a tall ship is about, and it's done for free. So it's something that our downtown tourism can sink their teeth into. It's something that if you're new to Kingston, if you're new to the country, and you're not familiar with the tall ships, you can see one that's actually working. And then any youth who has any sort of curiosity about our water and wants to see what a tall ship is about. What a great opportunity to come down with your family and have a tour of the boat and see what it's about. This, as we heard from our delegation today, that boat travels all over Eastern Ontario, well, all over Ontario, really, Lake Ontario, and then through the Atlantic Ocean, from New York City to Halifax and everywhere along the Eastern Seaboard. This is an opportunity for us to really lean into our tall ship experience here in Kingston. This is its home dock. This is an opportunity for us to really bring something forward where the public can enjoy it and Kingston can take pride in it. You heard the captain speak. He is now going to be going through Tourism Kingston, and it'll be representing us at other ports. We need to embrace at our end its home port and what we can do for it. We are a city that says we thrive on history and innovation. History is here, and we have an opportunity to support it and let it thrive.
With council support, city staff are set to report back to council in the second quarter of 2026, with options for implementing fee waivers or cost reductions at city-operated marinas, along with an analysis of the financial costs and benefits to the city. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about TLTI Council's approval of new recycling depot changes.
Thank you, Jesse. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands Council has unanimously approved a series of waste management measures that will reshape how recycling and household garbage are handled across the township beginning in 2026. The decision authorizes staff to sign a change order with Circular Materials Ontario to renew the township's depot operations agreement for up to three additional one-year terms. The move comes as the province's shift to the extended producer responsibility model takes full effect on January 1st, 2026, transferring financial and operational control of Blue Box Recycling from municipalities to producers. Under the renewed agreement, TLTI would continue operating its three recycling depots, Lansdowne, Escott, and Briar Hill, but at a significantly reduced compensation rate from CMO. Revenue is projected to drop by roughly 43% next year, with an estimated $189,462 in 2025 to $108,600 in 2026. Council also directed staff to establish a dedicated recycling depot for non-eligible sources such as churches, daycares, not-for-profits, commercial farms, campgrounds, and municipal facilities, which producers are no longer required to service under the new rules. Councillor Angela Kelman raised concerns about how the township would determine whether material arriving at the depot was coming from a residence or from a non-eligible source. Rather than operating separate bins at all three depots, an option staff estimated would cost roughly $25,000 per site annually, council opted to centralize non-eligible recycling drop-off at the Lansdowne landfill. Council further directed the Operations and Infrastructure Department to conduct a financial and operational review of introducing township-wide curbside collection for household garbage, which is currently delivered to landfill sites by residents. Mayor Karina Smith-Gatsky emphasized that the decision simply gives staff the authority to gather facts before council makes any major commitments. The municipality's recycling program is in a period of rapid change. Under the province's EPR framework, CMO will assume full responsibility for residential blue box recycling as of January 1st. Municipalities can continue to operate depots, but at standardized and significantly lower rates. Staff noted that if TLTI declined to sign the change order, CMO would still require the township to operate depots without compensation, or alternatively, TLTI could cease operating recycling depots entirely, forcing residents to travel to the nearest site in front of Yonge. Staff described both alternatives as unworkable. The 2026 operating budget already accounts for reduced recycling revenues and the costs associated with the non-eligible materials depot in Lansdowne. Staff will report back next year on the feasibility of a curbside garbage collection program, including potential cost savings and operational impacts. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstell, about an arbitration decision related to the Queen's University Faculty Association.
Thank you, Dinah. An arbitrator has partially upheld a grievance filed by the Queen's University Faculty Association, or QFA, over the university's requirement that faculty install third-party security software on any device used for work. After reviewing submissions from both sides and holding a hearing in Kingston on November 4th, arbitrator William Kaplan ruled on November 7th that the grievance was justified, in part. The decision directs Queen's to make several significant changes affecting device reimbursement, cybersecurity protocols, and the implementation of technological changes. According to the decision, QFA's grievance was filed when the university administration adopted a new rule requiring faculty members to install third-party monitoring software. QFA argued the policy was unreasonable, violated academic freedom and privacy rights, and ignored the need for transparency and meaningful consultation. The grievance also claimed the requirement conflicted with several articles of the collective agreement, including provisions addressing discipline, privacy, and decision-making through joint committees. QFA also noted that the administration had admitted more work was needed to ensure transparency and informed consent, yet it still went ahead with the new rule regardless. According to QFA, this was unreasonable and an improper use of management authority. Lastly, QFA considered the policy unreasonable because it did not account for the special privacy concerns in a university setting, where the free exchange of ideas through teaching and research is essential. QFA said the administration's unilateral action also ignored the fact that faculty have a reasonable expectation of privacy on any device they use for work, no matter who paid for it. One significant component of Kaplan's ruling directs all Queen's faculties and departments to reimburse faculty members for purchasing devices, including mobile phone upgrades, through existing professional expense accounts. The ruling clarifies that term adjunct faculty are also entitled to these reimbursements and that their expense funds must be released early in the academic term once the required forms are submitted. The decision also requires the creation of a new Standing Joint Committee on Technology, SJCT. The committee will include three QFA-appointed faculty members, the university's chief information officer, and two representatives appointed by the Queen's Provost. Beginning in January 2026, the committee will meet quarterly to discuss technology issues affecting working conditions. In addition, Queen's must now provide the committee with a detailed written report every quarter outlining all security threats detected by this software that will require university intervention. The report must include sufficient detail to provide the committee with complete transparency into the nature of each threat and the university's response. Under the ruling, Queen's Information Technology, or IT Services, must hold in-person information sessions for QFA members at least 4 months before introducing new, major technological requirements. These sessions must allow for questions and meaningful dialogue. All significant technology changes must also be discussed at both the new SJCT and the Joint Committee to Administer the Agreement, JCAA, levels. The arbitrator also ordered Queen's to consult with QFA before finalizing several key policies, including the new Exceptional Access Authorization Procedure and the Cybersecurity Policy for Faculty. Consultation is also required before renewing the Electronic Monitoring Transparency Policy in 2027. Within 30 days, QFA and the university must attempt to agree on an external provider to conduct a new privacy impact assessment of the software used. If they cannot agree, Kaplan will choose the provider from a list of names submitted by both parties. The assessment must focus on the protection of personal, research, and intellectual property data. The results must be shared with QFA, and Queen's must consult on any recommended changes. Kaplan concluded by stating that he will remain seized of the matter, meaning he will stay involved to help resolve any disputes over the implementation of his ruling.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the reduction of a proposed residential tax rate in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
This week, Loyalist Township held its second of three budget meetings and saw the proposed residential tax rate increase drop to 3.64%. The first meeting saw a proposed 4.97%, but members of the committee said they wanted to see it under 4%. The township's director of finance and treasurer, David Clazy, explains how they came to the new number.
We've been made aware of some additional supplementary assessment through MPAC. And as well, we have also received the final 2026 assessment rule at the end of last week. So in conjunction with that new assessment, that will generate an additional $165,000 in new taxation revenue, which has the potential alone of decreasing our tax requirement by 0.7%. So when you basically put those all together, that has a net reduction in the tax levy requirement of $303,000. We're now looking at a revised residential tax increase of 3.64%. So that results in a $24.457 million of tax levy requirement. And again, the amount of debt and the contributions to capital is unchanged from the previous day.
The township's third and final 2026 budget meeting will take place December 2nd.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the Swana Arts and Cultural Festival in Prince Edward County.
From the minute I took my shoes off, respecting the Swana culture, the vibe was lively with kids running around and infectious music welcoming me. Saturday was the first of hopefully many Swana Prince Edward County Arts and Cultural Festivals, celebrating the traditions and customs of Southwestern Asia and North Africa. Organizer Cami Abrahamian guided me through the displays and activities and let me loose to explore everything Swana. The family-friendly event had something for everyone. Kids lined up for face painting while others took part in an Armenian embroidery lesson or culinary class. Families relaxed in the traditional living room setting, enjoying regional food and coffees, while tired-out kids could lounge in the cool-down tent. I could barely stop moving to the regional music while admiring and sampling the magnificent cakes. I've never seen anything like these cakes. So beautiful. It was a shame to cut into them, but they were delicious. Cami Abrahamian tells us more.
Who am I speaking with today?
My name is Cami Abrahamian.
And what is this event?
It is the Swana PEC Arts and Culture Festival. It is the first of its kind in Prince Edward County. And it is basically a gathering around Swana culture and art and music and food, so much food. And basically we wanted to make people feel like they were walking into a Swana person's home. When I say Swana, I mean Southwest Asian, North African, which is an anti-colonial term for what other people know as the Middle East.
And so what countries would that include?
Oh my goodness, the long list. Armenia, Turkey, Azerbaijan, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Sudan. Oh my God, there's so many more that I'm missing. Kurdistan, Georgia, Libya, Palestine, Lebanon. There are more.
Okay.
There are more.
That's okay. Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Is there a particular religion to this celebration today, or just the culture?
Just culture. Yeah, there's many, many religions in that region, and this particular celebration is not religious specific. It makes space for all the diversity of cultures, to represent all the diversity of cultures and religions, but it is not a religious gathering at all. No. And actually, like, that region is very well known for its diversity in culture, in ethnicity, in tribes, in religion. And for a very long time, they cohabitated in perfect harmony, you know, until other folks came through.
Right.
Yeah, pitted
right.
us against each other. But for the most part, what we wanted to do with this event is really We wanted to share Swana culture and celebrate Swana culture. It's been a rough couple of years, as you know, with everything that's happening in Gaza and the war in Artsakh and even in Sudan. It's been a rough few years. I mean, it's been rough for a long time for people for that region, but it's been a particularly rough couple of years with the genocide especially. And we really just wanted a moment to just celebrate because our culture is so rich and so diverse and so generous, and we wanted to just take a minute to celebrate that instead of just being sad all the time.
Yes.
And share that with the community also.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I'm not sure. I think I'm just really grateful to Prince Edward County for showing up for this. You know, we really didn't know what it was going to be like, but so many people have shown up, and that means a lot to me. I moved to Prince Edward County 8 years ago, and for me, I felt largely quite culturally isolated. There aren't a lot of Swana people here, but that didn't, over the years, I found some, and then over the years, you know, I realized that Prince Edward County is becoming this really diverse place, and we put this event on not just for locals but also for tourists who are coming through to say there are many different sides of PEC, you know, and we're here and welcome to our home. We really wanted this to feel like people were walking into the home, right? So a lot of food, a lot of noise, a lot of chaos, a lot of hugging, right? So yeah, that's why we put it on.
And music,
exactly, dancing all the time. Yeah, thank you so much for coming.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, FrequencyNews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about ongoing budget negotiations between Cobourg City Council and the city's chief of police.
Cobourg Police Chief Paul Vandergraaff is once again defending his 2026 proposed budget, which would see a 20.5% increase from last year's budget. Vandergraaff went before Municipal Council Monday afternoon, stating there is zero discretionary funding and this budget reflects the true cost of policing. 911 dispatch fees with Owen Sound Police are going up. There is a 4% increase to staff wages and benefits, and some part-time hires are moving to full-time capacity. Of the approximate $12 million budget estimate, 81% will go to staff and wages. Court administration and security costs are going up as well. Vandergraaff said 11.5% of the budget will go to ensuring that investigations reach the conviction stage.
There's nowhere to cut. So in a year of 20.5%, sure would have been nice to lean that out to get you guys down to 16 or 15%. But unfortunately, over these years, to get to those numbers, we leaned out everything.
The Community Policing Act has required Cobourg Police to spend $900,000 to become compliant within the legislation. Increased costs for mental health training, more equipment, and updated armor for police cruisers are pushing up costs. For the past 10 years, Vandergraaff said police budgets have been operating in a deficit and that budgets have been very reliant on corporate services revenue. Vandergraaff explained that the budget of last year did not reflect what the cost of policing in Cobourg was, as the department dipped into its reserves to offset rising expenditures. Councillor Adam Bureau, who also sits on the Police Services Board, said this budget is a catch-up from previous budget mistakes.
Yes, this is the catch-up year for all of those years of mistakes, of maybe we should have had the 3% or 4%. There were so many compiling factors that are happening in this budget right now.
Bureau explained that he anticipates the proposed budget for 2027 would be in the single digits. The number of police calls are going up, as too is the staffing requirements per shift. If the 20.5% budget is passed, it would mean a 4.8% tax increase on the town budget. If not passed, conciliation and arbitration are options. The meeting at one point devolved as Mayor Lucas Cleveland wanted Vandergraaff to address, quote, allegations of financial mismanagement by the police board in previous years. Bureau and Vandergraaff both took responsibility for the current budget situation, with Vandergraaff adding that he believes the police board, too, is owning up to its participation. Council took the presentation for information purposes, and no decision on the police budget was made. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, December 11th, daytime high of minus 5, feeling closer to minus 8. Friday, December 12th, another minus 5 day, but about 4 degrees colder with an overnight low of minus 12. Saturday, December 13th, daytime high of minus 5, overnight low of minus 8. However, with the wind chill, it will feel closer to minus 12. Sunday, December 14th, daytime high of minus 4, overnight low of minus 10. And then kicking off next week, Monday, December 15th, daytime high of minus 5 with an overnight low of minus 13. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reminder that winter parking restrictions are in place as of December 1st. During December and March, overnight street parking will be banned only if the weather conditions require it. During January and February, overnight on-street parking is not permitted no matter the weather conditions. With construction season winding down, there are fewer road closures than you would typically expect. Here are three relevant road closures in the Kingston area. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. And Berry Street, Queen 2 Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson. Expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners. Expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. I'm your host, Adam, with co-hosts Sam and Kyle, and we've got some special guests in the stew today. It is a very special episode. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Jack Stubbs and Mr. Aiden Peterson. Jack, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Jack Stubbs, son of the very, very famous Mike Stubbs, broadcaster extraordinaire. Obviously, wanted to thank you guys for having me on the pod. Very excited to talk about some sports today.
And Mr. Peterson.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Adam, for hosting. I do not have the credentials that Mr. Stubbs has over here, but being a roommate of the great Adam Whale, I'm grateful that he invited us on to talk sports, and I'm excited to reconnect with some of my my close friends, Sam and Kyle, over there, and really talk about some good stuff today.
If I may interject, guys, it's really a pleasure to have you here. We're always happy to make a wish come true, and I'm really glad that we were able to help get us all together. So thank you for joining us. It's sort of a bilateral thing here. It wasn't a unilateral decision to bring you on, so we're quite pleased that you've been able to join us. Seeing as though this might be one of your last opportunities to speak on the radio since you're graduating soon.
I'm just excited that I get to reconnect with a former lover in Sam Schoenfeld, as well as a future lover in Kyle Sampson.
Okay, now moving on to some of the topics for today. So we are going to talk about the FIFA World Cup draw. We want to start with that because that was one of the most drawn out events that I've ever watched. I don't know if you guys got a chance to watch the FIFA World Cup draw, but some interesting presidents got a peace prize, which was very interesting, seeing that Haitian fans and Iranian fans are all limited in coming to the World Cup this upcoming summer. So let's talk about who Canada drew in the draw. The first one was Switzerland, then Qatar, and then the interesting one, the big whammy, the one we didn't want to happen, a potential matchup with Italy, as it's Italy and then three other teams, which will remain nameless for now because, come on, we think it's going to be Italy. But Italy's also choked the last two World Cups away, so they haven't even qualified, so it'll be really interesting to see. But Sam, Kyle, any input on the draw or seeing Mr. Wayne Gretzky, the great once there?
I think he confused the beach resort at Mar-a-Lago with a broadcast room there. Bumbled a couple words, not too surprised. But maybe he should go back to the boardroom on a couple of pronunciations there.
Yeah, I saw he couldn't pronounce Curacao, which is really tough one. Sam, any thoughts on seeing Gretzky or any of the other icons they had there?
Yeah, I mean, I think seeing Gretzky there purports a really strong argument as to why players in the OHL should continue going to high school when they start playing hockey at that level. But no, I don't know. I actually thought it was kind of cool. I mean, granted, I really don't want to play the Italians either. Although I do think Canada is the best team in its pool. I think Canada's better than Switzerland personally. That might be a hot take, but that's my definitely estimation at least. Yeah. I think that if the Italians do move on, Italy will win our pool, but Canada will still qualify, so that's not that big of a deal. I mean, I don't know. I don't think the Qataris are a better team than we are, but they're okay. They have more funding than we do for soccer, that's for sure. But no, in general, it's kind of cool. Like, you know, I mean, what do you want? Like, it's just kind of FIFA's kind of a bit of a pool hole festering of stench, and there's not that much interesting stuff going on. So watching Gretzky invent a couple countries like North Macedonia and watching Donald Trump draw the United States of America was definitely something. So I don't know. It's definitely the industry and the industry of entertainment. That's for sure.
No, that's very good intake. Now we're going to head over to our soccer analyst, Mr. Aiden Peterson. Any insight over there?
Well, it was kind of a tough slog watching the draw on YouTube that day. I was on a date with a girlfriend, and when I got tired of listening to her, I threw on the draw, and that was even worse, to be honest. But it was quite weird to see FIFA hand out a made up prize for someone who I don't think was in the top running for that prize at all. But in terms of soccer itself, I do think Canada has a great chance to qualify. I've been watching them in their friendlies. Up until the Ecuador game, they did not record a single win, but it was also completely clean sheets. So it was, you win some, you lose some on that side. I think Canada has a really good attacking squad. Jesse Marsh is really put something like a good product out there. We haven't had a good product from Canada in years in terms of soccer. But Sam, I know you think that we can beat Switzerland, but I've seen Switzerland in these world tournaments in the past, and they've beaten the likes of some footballing giants like France, and I think they could really give us a run for our money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sam, any rebuttal on that one?
I mean, no, I did say it was a hot take, and I agree. I mean, the Swiss can be good, but I don't know. I have faith in Canada. I have faith in Jesse Marsh, and I think that the roster's pretty solid. Granted, I don't disagree. The margin for error is pretty small with the Swiss, so it's not going to be an easy win. I mostly agree with that, although I'm not – yeah. AP, yeah, the real question there is how long did it take for you to switch over to the FIFA stream during the conversation? Maybe we'll cut that part out. Anyways.
Maybe a couple edits in this one.
Yeah.
I would say when we're talking about the state of Qatar in international soccer right now, the FIFA Arab Cup is actually happening. I don't know if everyone's aware of that. But Qatar actually was brutalized by Palestine and Tunisia and ended up losing in the group stage. So I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of faith in Qatar. I'm happy that they were drawn for Canada's group, but everything else is looking a little bleak. Let's just hope the boys can score some goals.
Yeah, I do think that's probably like the only win of the group is getting Qatar, because I feel like Switzerland is one of the better teams that was not in that first pot.
Yep.
And Italy is going to be probably the best team out of pot four, which is crazy if they make it. We do have to clarify that they have not qualified yet, and it is not a done deal. Speaking of international competitions, Team Canada released their World Juniors roster. For training camp, they announced 27 players. Sam, I think Kyle sent it to the group chat earlier this week. Any surprises early on? I know I was excited to see Montreal Canadiens prospect Michael Hage on the roster. Any surprises from your guys' point of view?
I think it seems like this year they kind of went back to the drawing board, not trying to do any crazy strategies and, I don't know, playing politics essentially as much. So a bit more of like a standard roster of just our better players. But yeah, everyone still remembers last year pretty well. So I think there's a lot of pressure to not play the same kind of political games as before, even though it's probably still going to happen.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it's a solid team. I really think they did go with the best in this scenario. What do you guys think of the goaltending? Because I know they have some goaltenders who have played in the last couple World Juniors. They got Carter George and Jack Ivankovic, who were both part of the roster last year, I believe. And they added Joshua Ravensbergen, who is one of the top goalie prospects right now. Is goaltending maybe on the up for Canada? I know this is obviously something we've talked about a few times on the podcast about the international caliber of goaltending for Team Canada. But is this a sign that maybe they've got some life? Is this a Canadian goalie dynasty?
I mean, I heard a really interesting perspective on goaltending and why Canada has been suffering in it. But for the longest time, Canadian goaltending was successful just because of pure talent. And we kind of like stopped realizing what makes a good goaltender, and 90% of it's coaching. So like producing good goaltenders comes from a system of good coaches that actually train goaltenders from when they're, you know, starting prospects. That's been the problem in Canada, is mostly the fact that we've just been able to just produce good goalies by chance, not actually like having to work for it essentially. So that's part of the reason why other countries have been more successful, because they've really had to work for each player to make it, whereas we kind of just have our players naturally enter the NHL.
No, it's a good point. Sam, any thoughts on that? I know you were interested in Zane Parekh too. That's a guy for you, eh?
Well, yeah, I know. Actually, I just think that guy's pretty impressive as a general rule. I don't know if anyone follows him too closely, but he's a bit of an academic weapon as well. If I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure he finished his undergraduate degree at university already while playing in the OHL. He skipped a few grades. From what I understand, he's supposed to be a really, really smart kid, and he's pretty good at hockey too. I think he's projected to go 8th overall by the NHL Network. So I mean, I just think we have a good roster. In terms of the goaltending, I mean, you know, maybe AP can speak a bit better to this because he actually is a goalie and he's trained in goaltending. But I do think Canada has a paucity of good goalies at the international level, especially in the NHL. I don't know if this is the advent of a new era of goaltending. This might just be a one-off. But the big thing about the World Juniors that I think a lot of people forget is that they're not entirely indicative of future success. I mean, I can't really name a goaltending example off the top of my head, mostly because I forget the goalie's name. But I want to say in the late 2000s, a goalie from Canada was drafted in the top three.
Carey Price.
He was a prodigy in the World Juniors. And yeah, exactly. And then he just never moved on, really.
Whoa.
So, I mean, as much as it's great to have good goaltending going into this to reclaim our title as the best development country in the world for hockey, I don't think it's necessarily a given that these guys are going to be NHL superstars.
100%. I agree with you there, Sam. Like, as a goalie myself, when you change different leagues, for example, let's talk about a very, very close to heart example here. When you go from Lug to Intramurals, it's a different game. It's a different game. So I can't imagine the difference between going from the junior level to the professional level. You see lots of people, lots of goalies who have fiery starts in World Juniors just flutter out as soon as they get to the pros. And this can be due to development or getting shocked because they're on a bad team because they're drafted high. And then they get puck shy and it's just a huge mess. An example which is kind of the opposite of this is when Levi Marilainen used to play for the Kingston Frontenacs. I went to go see him a couple times. And me and my roommates all thought he was not going to make it to the pros. We thought he was terrible. And I was disappointed as a Sens fan that he was one of our top goalie prospects. But seeing him over the past couple of years has really, like my eye test, has really changed my view on him. And he's coming to his own here. So I'm thinking it's the style of league, OHL, low defense, high scoring. And also it's on the goalie to develop themselves as well, because you're not going to see young stars be consistent in the league as a goalie. You'll see that over time through their consistency in training and development.
No, good insight. Stubbs, anything you want to say about the roster? Any comments you can say? I know we have to clarify, Jack Stubbs is very limited in what he can say. He's an insider.
Whoa. I have no puck knowledge when it comes to a lot of these things, but I'm familiar enough with obviously the Hunters, with like a lot of goings on in the junior hockey world, but I don't want to say I'm an expert. I love that we're mentioning that Hockey Canada is in itself a political body. I would like to call it a couple other words as opposed to that, but I'm gonna keep my little stint brief here. I think it's actually less political than it's been in the future, other than the fact that looking at this list, there's only one Knights player on it, right? And that's very much the Sam O'Reilly, who is the guy for the job. If Dale had it his way, I think there would be a whole lot of names on there. If we're talking goalkeepers, we'd obviously have like an Alexei Medvedev or something, just to kind of bring it home, bring it back to him. But I don't know.
Medvedev might be Russian.
Oh shoot, he is. Yeah. I'm actually insane.
No, that's that's
this is where my puck knowledge comes in.
He is a great goalie. We talked about him on the podcast.
He's on the Russian team. I do know this. Yeah.
I talked to
my dad can't listen to this one, guys. I have to scrap it. Oh man.
No, that is all good. We talked about Medvedev after the game I went to with you guys. Mm-hmm. Actually, I brought it up to Sam or Kyle. I think it was one of the ones where I was just doing with Kyle. And Medvedev, I said, is a freak. Like he looks like he's going to be the future of the NHL. Like literally. Like so big. I mean, he's a big guy, right? Gosh. And that does help when you're trying to save the puck. But
if
just
only
like
he was Canadian.
If only he was Canadian, yeah. The Canadians could use a goaltender like that. And I think that's what we're getting at is they got to develop them more because Medvedev is definitely a product of the Russian hockey experience. And I think that it's going to be a very competitive World Juniors team. I do want to pivot a bit to the NHL and talk a little bit about what we've got going on there. There's some movement in the standings. Two teams are really pulling away from the rest of the pack. Dallas and Colorado are two teams that look like it's going to be them moving on in the West. I mean, there's really no competition in the West right now. And that looks like kind of one of them's going to be the Stanley Cup final. I mean, candidate, right? I mean, is that too early to say that? Maybe, but like, the Avalanche are already up to 48 points. Like that is brutal. That is incredible to be that far ahead. So Stubbs, AP, I'll start with you guys. Do you think that Colorado and Dallas are locks for playoffs?
Mm, Locks for playoffs.
Locks for playoffs. Yeah, I mean, it would take quite the fall off.
Yeah, I put my entire life savings on both Dallas and Colorado to make the first round of the playoffs. After that, who knows? And barring any insane injuries to their top players like McKinnon, Rantanen, Roope Hintz, like, as long as they can keep a solid core going, they will be A-OK, but it all depends on how they can perform in the playoffs if they want that cup.
And I think we got two teams here that have a lot of playoff experience. Both of them have made deep runs in the past. So it will be really interesting to see. I don't know how much of Dallas's team is back from like that. Remember that Stanley Cup Finals run?
Yeah.
I don't know how many returning players, but I do know Colorado still got a decent chunk from their cup run. Sam, Kyle, any comments on Dallas or Colorado or a team that we should look out for in the West? Maybe a little bit of a dark horse?
I mean, Edmonton in the last two games has dropped two nukes, so I don't know. I wouldn't count them at 100%, but Dallas and the Avalanche look pretty scary. I don't know though. I mean, after watching Dallas last year in the playoffs, it's pretty much the same team, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they didn't look that dangerous, if I'm being honest. Like, they kind of had a lot of parts of their game fall apart in the playoffs. Like, Edmonton steamrolled them. There's no saying that they were close in that series. Like, they literally just got run over.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they got some things to work on. Part of the issue was Robertson not producing as much as he could, but it seems like he's kind of been revitalized a little bit. The only unfortunate thing with him is he's known to be streaky.
Yeah.
So he can be hot and then really cold kind of out of nowhere. So I don't know. I mean, if he keeps on this pace, which I always thought he's a 100-point player, and the fact that he hasn't been getting 100 points or more consistently is kind of surprising. But I think he's in a sustainable pace, unless he just goes cold out of nowhere.
No, I know what you mean. I think last year was definitely an outlier for him. I mean, I was surprised to see how little production he had. So I think now he's kind of back finding his game. And I mean, it's really translating to a lot of points for these teams. Sam, Kyle already said Edmonton. Is there a team in the West that you like that's not Dallas or Colorado? Maybe someone from the Pacific Division that's in the playoffs right now. They've right now got Anaheim, Vegas, or the Kings. Any of those teams sound like the winner?
I'm about to say the craziest thing we've ever said on this show. I think Chicago's going to make the playoffs, and I think they're actually going to make it pretty far. Here's the thing. If Chicago makes two good trades, just two, and they get someone that Bedard can pass the puck to in good consciousness and know he's not turning it over, they will make the playoffs, and they will have a decent run. I think Chicago's kind of slept on. I think Bedard is awake. There's a really famous quote from Napoleon that says, you should let China sleep because when it wakes, it'll shake the world. And I think Bedard just woke up, and I think he's going to shake the world. So all I need is two extra players.
Is that a connection to Bedard being of similar stature to Napoleon? Or what's the connection there?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I've just been reading a lot of Napoleon quotes recently more than anything.
Oh, as one does. Fair enough. Anyone in the East that we're taking a look at? One team I'm surprised at, Washington, being top of the Metro. I honestly thought last year was a bit of a fluke. I didn't think they were that good. I didn't think they looked that good against Montreal in the first round. And here they are doing it again. The Metro is also the tougher division right now in the East. The Atlantic is kind of jammed up, but the Metro is tougher points-wise. Do you think Washington's sustainable? I know they got Carolina right there looking behind them. Sam, you're shaking my head. You're shaking your head. No, you don't think Washington's sustainable?
No, I think they are about to crash. I think this is just a stroke of luck that they have a couple wins. I mean, they're a good team, whatever. They have a winning culture, sure, whatever you want to say. But at the end of the day, when your average age is 36 years old, you're bound to start slowing down eventually. And it's just an old team. They're not that good. I think Ovi's pretty overrated, personally. I think they're just trying to leave around.
Yeah.
See what happens. You can get a couple more goals. I know that's a rude thing to say. How dare I say that about an NHL future Hall of Famer and an undisputed legend, probably top 20, top 10 all time. But I don't know. Washington's not going to make the playoffs. They're not a good team.
No.
They'll fall.
I
will say this, though. Ottawa's fall from being a playoff contender to absolute garbage is grossly unparalleled by anyone else's downfall this season so far. And I think we need to mention that because there's a couple Suns fans on the call.
Yeah. They're only 4 points out. Let's not. And I do want to clarify one thing for Stubbs and AP. I'm a big Ovechkin guy. Sam's a huge Crosby guy, so he rips on Ovechkin as often as he can because I've said Ovechkin is better than Crosby on multiple occasions.
I don't think Ovechkin's bad. I think he's a great player. I just think he's kind of like dust on the shelf, and every once in a while when you give it a sniff, it kind of flies away. I'm just saying, like, you know, dust doesn't stay around forever, and that's okay.
I still think Ovechkin.
I will say this thing. That video I sent to our group chat a couple days ago of the Washington locker room, I feel like that the reason why I thought that video was really interesting is because I feel like it's like another perspective on why Ovechkin's a great captain slash player. Mm-hmm. Like the Washington Capitals are the exact opposite of the Senators. They have a great locker room culture that's actually friends with each other, whereas the Senators are like just a bunch of young kids that prank each other, like Brady Tkachuk sawing into Claude Giroux's sticks and forgetting about it in an actual NHL game, and Claude Giroux went to shoot the puck and his stick snapped immediately. Goes to grab another one, snaps. All four of his sticks he brought on a road game were filed down by Tkachuk.
Yeah, I did see that.
No serious team does this kind of thing.
Yeah.
No, AP Stubbs, any comments on that?
No, I saw the exact video you're talking about, Kyle, and in the moment I thought it was pretty funny. I was kind of laughing along with the Tkachuk brothers there, but You got to see it from G's perspective as well, because he's on the ice. He's trying to produce as much as he can, and just to have his sticks break on first contact with the puck is just embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a professional league, and I understand you're trying to keep the spirits high within your locker room, but there's other ways to do it, and not to have the awareness to actually understand that the sticks are still filed down and replace them. It's interesting. But another thing I want to talk about on the Ottawa Senators is their goaltending. And their goaltending this season has been a dumpster fire. Linus Ullmark, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his first name, but last in the league, and I'm not talking 32nd, I'm talking 78th in saves above expected. He will make the routine stop, but if the team needs him to make that extra stop when the defense fumbles, he will not be there. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Senators have had a fall from grace.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I saw that his backup isn't doing much better. Is it Marilainen? Yeah, he's down there too. He's like 64th or something like that. It's definitely rough days if you're a Senators goalie. For the last couple minutes of the podcast, I want to move over to the NFL, talk about the upcoming playoff picture, because it's getting close to the end of the season and games mean a lot. I want to start with the Detroit Lions. So, Mr. Stubbs, I want to hear the overall, what do you think the odds are that the Lions are able to make the playoffs? Looking at their schedule, looking at the players they got, what's it looking like for the Lions?
Well, actually, we know the odds right now with that win over Dallas on Thursday. They were boosted, I believe, a 55% chance of making the playoffs. And although, man, I've seen a lot of bad Detroit Lions teams in my life, this is not a bad Detroit Lions team by any means. They're a team that struggles with injuries, and they're a team that struggles with a lot of character right now. So I'm not loving that, but what, we have 5 games left in the season?
Yep.
If they win those 5, which are not going to be easy, we got LA next. I think we have to play the Bears. I say we as if I'm on the team.
Hey, but you are.
Hey, I love these boys so much. This is my lifeblood right here. It's not going to be easy, but stranger things have happened, and I love to watch some Detroit Lions football.
So shout out Josh, Stranger Things. Moving on to the Bills and the Bengals, two teams that looked incredible this past weekend. Mine is Joe Burrow. I don't know if Sam, Kyle, you got a chance to watch that crazy game or any of the highlights, but definitely game of the year.
Man, the Lord blessed us to play in some snow. That quote from Jameis Winston was held true that day. That was a beautiful game to watch until Joe Burrow gave that muffin to the defense.
Yeah, it was quite the muffin. Buffalo ate that up and returned it all the way to the end zone for a nasty pick 6. But Cincinnati still got a chance. They've got to win out, essentially, and pray for some Steelers losses, some Ravens losses. Is that how it's going to work for them?
A little bit of a mix of both. They will not be making the playoffs if they are looking out of a division title and into the playoffs. So they need to win the division. And that means the Steelers have to lose 3 of their next 4 at least. And the Ravens, they're only 2 games ahead. So the Bengals got to catch up. The Bengals just have to win out, and then you hope the football gods are nice, and then they can get some luck on that side.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, another team praying for some luck, the Miami Dolphins are still alive. They are the same record as the Cincinnati Bengals, I believe, and they've got a chance to make the playoffs. If they win out, it's very slim. They definitely need some losses to happen, but that would be crazy because Miami's been abysmal this year. It's just crazy to see the difference in the AFC and the NFC. I think the NFC is just so stacked right now, and the AFC, it's like all these garbo teams are fighting for the last spot. I mean, like, I'm going to say it. Buffalo's pretty garbage this year. And I mean, that's like the five seed or the six seed? That's kind of crazy, especially when you look at the tough records in the NFC. I mean, it's a shame. I think Detroit or Chicago, one of the teams aren't going to make the playoffs. And I think a team might not make, a team might miss the playoffs at 11-6, which I don't think we've seen in recent years. Mm-mm. Yeah, no, it will definitely be crazy to see. I definitely have more faith in the Lions than I do in the Bears to make the playoffs. But the Bears have been doing something interesting this year. They've been playing well above their expected, I would say.
I like watching Caleb Williams, and I really don't like saying that. I think Ben Johnson has done a phenomenal job at figuring out what he's good at and calling plays that truly, truly showcase what he's got. Like, he's a talent. He's always been a talent. I'm just happy he's not Trevor Lawrence.
Yeah, no, fair enough, I mean, speaking of Trevor Lawrence, the Jags are in a playoff spot, too. I mean, these teams are all coming together. C.J. Stroud and the Texans look great. I think it's going to be a very exciting playoffs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Sam, I know your favorite player, Aaron Rodgers, is leading the Steelers right now. Right now, they're first in the division, and I know he's your guy. So is the ayahuasca working? Is this, like, how he works? Is he the ageless wonder that we all think he is?
I mean, yeah, man, this type of thing happens when you're the most unvaccinated player in the league. And, you know, I can't blame him for continuing to excel like this. You know, after you drink enough jungle juice over your life, you tend to extend your bodily limits beyond that of what you'd expect of someone of his age and stature. But, you know, I think we should all just be really blessed to be alive in his era. Forevermore shall the NFL look back upon these fond times and speak not of the man named Aaron, but of the man who did not vaccinate. And for those reasons, I think he's just a cultural icon and a football icon. And I have nothing but praise for the guy. So I'm not surprised that he's excelling in every capacity.
You're saying you're a massive Shailene Woodley fan then?
I don't even know who that is, but. That's
you know what? We're just going to leave it at that.
We will say this is a satirical show. We all think that vaccines save lives. Yep. This is Sam trying to be funny, and he's succeeding.
No, we do. I actually do think vaccines save lives, guys. This is totally a joke.
Yes. Another ageless wonder, Philip Rivers just got signed by the Indianapolis Colts at 44 years old. And that's pretty much like my dad out there playing quarterback for the Colts. Do you guys think he's going to be successful? AP, Stubbs, Philip Rivers.
Bring on Anthony Richardson. I don't think it's going to go super well.
I think if Philip Rivers can score more touchdowns than he has kids, it's considered a successful season.
That will be interesting to see if he's able to eclipse that number. But I was trying to think of, like, in this last minute we've got here, is there an NHL equivalent to one player that would come out of retirement that would be like a Philip Rivers kind of guy? Is there a recent player that, I mean, we don't see it too much in the NHL with players trying to make comebacks. I know Milan Lucic just tried and kind of failed. I saw he's taken his talents to the UK. But is there any recent retired players that might pull a comeback like that?
I mean, there's a couple guys who were, I mean, I can't even say this on the radio, Adam. You know I can't answer this question, but there's a couple guys who've been out of hockey for a while who are trying to make a comeback. But the best one that comes to mind is Mario Lemieux. I mean, he had cancer and came back. And then I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I mean, that's not recent, but that's the best example I can think of.
No.